I'm Maggie Ling. Welcome to On the Shelf, the oxymoronic life of an underpublished writer, and to this first episode, which I've entitled Once Upon a Time. To begin at the beginning, as Dylan Thomas began Under Milk Wood. Let's start at the very beginning, Oscar Hammerstein suggested in The Sound of Music. Begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end, the king instructed Alice in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. For this beginning, the first in a series on the joys and woes of being an underpublished fiction writer, as well as readings from my soon-to-be-published short story collection, Appetites, Stories of Love, Sex and Death, I am following Oscar's dictum and going back to start at the very beginning of my life, to begin in that once-upon-a-time world of childhood and explore the importance of words, of the written word, to me in those new-to-the-world years, when the word bug took its first bite, drew blood and refused to let go, infecting writers like myself for a lifetime. Coming late to what was always my first love, only setting out on what I hoped would be my last tranche career at the age of 54, this late period of storytelling has taught me that you don't have to begin at the beginning. You can start at the end, or towards the end, as I've done, or begin in the middle. The important thing is to start. For if the words are there in your head, if they are beginning to bug you, whether they be beginning words, middle words, or end words, they are words that must be trapped on paper, netted on screen, caught in a phone or a digital recorder. Because words, elusive little darlings that they are, can be magically present at one moment and dispersed into the ether before you can say abracadabra the next. And once gone, transformative shapeshifters one and all, they are unlikely to return in the same form again. So get them down. It doesn't matter in what order, just get them down before they escape for good. The word bug got its teeth into me pretty early. I can clearly remember the pleasure of learning to read and write, although that's not quite right, in the sense I cannot recall the learning process. It must have come easily to me. I remember only the pleasure of reading and writing. The joy of writing down words which, until then, I had only heard spoken to me or by me. Words I could now spell, could write myself. Short, easy words, medium-sized words, more difficult words. Words I would break down into smaller pieces to help me remember how to spell them. Syllables. A word that sounds like some sweet concoction a child might want to eat. Aeroplane was an early favourite. Though not the up-in-the-air letter I you would expect of that form of transportation, but with an E. Chrysanthemum was another. A flower now growing in the garden of the new council house to which my family had recently moved. Chrysanthemum, with that first silent H. And pneumonia, a serious bout of which I had survived as a baby, soon after moving from my father's home county of Norfolk to the Suffolk birthplace of my mother. The damp tithe cottage we moved to, a ditch running along the apology for a garden, a contributing factor in giving me a lung condition I continued to suffer from later in life. Yet, 4 years after recovering from it, I took great pleasure in spelling this word that my body had experienced before my mind had any knowledge of it. Pneumonia. Remembering to always use that single U, not the W of New Dawn, the inaptly named house we had recently vacated for the brand new one in Coronation Close. Another of the confusing joys of the language I was learning. I can see the big round lowercase letters of my small child's hand, triumphantly adding another long word to the list of those I could now spell. From a working-class family in rural East Anglia, my 1950s education was minimal to the point of being almost non-existent. The village school I attended consisted of the little room and the big room. In my time there, the first 2 years in the little room were strictly ruled by the appropriately named Miss Birch, who, should she feel the need to wrap the back of an inattentive pupil's hand with it, would make frequent use of her wooden ruler. Though thanks to my early love of letters, if not numbers, I think my knuckles escaped a beating. In fact, as an early convert to the pure pleasure of the English language, I and my new school friend, Carol Smith, a friend whose family moved from the area soon afterwards, sadly, were often called upon by Miss Birch to assist older pupils to read. Usually boys, as I recall. Boys who had moved on to the big room, still unable to do so. The noisy big room, where those selfsame boys might, for a lark, sometimes ride their bikes through it. The free-for-all room where, aside from a story read to us at the end of the day by the headmaster, the chaos theory of education ruled. I wonder what a child psychologist would say now about this bipolar approach to the shaping of young minds, or perhaps to the warping of them, or the benign neglect. Did the chaotic conditions of my childhood, did this dynamical system of education determine my present situation, I wonder? On the one hand, I know the quietly serious academic child inside me did not get the stimulation she craved. Yet, on the other hand, would that freewheeling school, a primary, primarily there, it appeared, to keep the working classes in their place, did give me, was time. Time in which to write stories and to illustrate them, as well as on request on a daily basis, to draw pictures for the other children to colour in. Time, since there was a shortage of both lessons in my school day and discipline within it, to structure that day for myself, to impose my own self-discipline. This early learning experience standing me in good stead more than 20 years later, when I began my self-employed freelance career as a children's book illustrator, and then as a cartoonist. And later still, when I embarked on what I hoped would be my new career as a published writer. Although the paucity of lessons, particularly in mathematics, in which I dabbled briefly each school day, meant I failed the 11 plus, and at the top of the A stream in my first year at secondary school, the 12 plus also, what this Summerhill for Serfs did do, more by its nature than design, was help nurture my natural love of language, a love which would shape my later life. The unruly education of my first decade also gave me that blank canvas I find an excellent backdrop for a writer, an empty diary, white space of time on the calendar, no commitments, hopefully for days on end. Just time. Time to oneself. Time alone to let the mind wander. Time to be filled with as yet unknown words, unknown characters. Time to see who will walk into that empty space and fill it. As a consequence, this initial beginning of my writing life, the years from 5 to 11, and particularly those from 7 to 11, were extremely productive ones for me. Aside from filling numerous Grey East Suffolk County Education Committee classroom books with illustrated stories while at school, I also wrote what I considered to be novels at home. There was no such thing as homework at my school. In my story, Running Away, the protagonist, Lenny Girl, looks back to her school days and to those she was forced to miss, staying at home in the tiny dark flat, looking after her adored brother, Luki. And in keeping with the theme, I will begin at the beginning of the story. Running away. In my perverse mind, it's summertime, that hot summer of 1976, which of course it could not have been since Luki was born in January. Even so, I persist in seeing it this way, seeing my mother in bikini and tie-dyed sarong, drifting from shaded bedroom to sun-scorched balcony, a whiff of coconut suntan lotion wafting through time to perfume this dull autumn afternoon. Bob Marley is playing on the record player, running away, running through my head. Though again, I am conflating an early memory with a later one, a time when Bob's words were blasted full volume, blasted beyond the grave, my mother grieving her double loss. These sounds, these scents, I will always associate with my first sight of Luki, lying on a fluffy white towel, spread out on the rainbow-coloured quilt of my parents' bed. Seeing him there, evidencing no sign of blood or breath, I thought him a lifeless doll baby. Thought, this ugly, sweet creature cannot be my brother. He looks like the toy baby my grandmother gave me for Christmas. I imagined Luki's body to be floppy soft and his pale, smooth head, showing none of the white blonde hair to come, to be as hard and as fragile as porcelain. Suspected that beneath the white nappy drawn up between his colourless legs, my alleged sibling's sexless doll status lay hidden. "Take him, Arlene," my mother would urge me. "Hold your brother. He's as light as air. Come on, take him in your arms." Hands clasped behind my back, fingers nervously entwined, shaking my head, I would offer some lame excuse and back out of the room, refusing to hold Luki for fear of breaking his doll's head. I was 5 years old that winter and had been at White House Primary for 4 months, and yet no rose-tinted memories of a favourite teacher or a much-loved playmate have travelled with me through life. All the childhood memories I own, all I can recall, have Luki at their centre. From the start, my brother was the centre of my world. "Stop, Daddy, stop!" I was fearful too, should I catch Luki being swung in my father's long, strong arms. His tilting carousel swings had a frightening energy, a degree of danger that caused my heart to race, my voice to yell, "Please stop! Think of Luki's baby brain!"
"Lenny."
He always called me Lenny, because, as my mother later admitted, he had hoped for, had wanted me to be a boy.
"He's a flesh and blood baby. You're not made of glass. He won't break."
Unconvinced by my father's assertions, I would continue watching fearfully, hoping my agitated presence could calm the trajectory of those rockabye swings. Waiting until safely back in his cot, I could pull the honeycomb blanket over Luki's fragile body. And throughout that first year, I believed my brother to be no ordinary flesh and blood baby. Believed him born of a more mysterious alchemy than the everyday love that had made me. Imagined he came from some faraway fairy tale land, a land of snow palaces, white knights and whey-faced princesses who slept on goose down and bathed in milk. To me, Luki was too pale a creature to possess such a life-giving, life-taking liquid as blood. My whiter-than-white brother. The child I see now, swinging in his father's dark brown arms. Our father came from Grenada.
Do they have snow there, Daddy?
It was Lukey's first summer.
Do they have rivers of milk?
No, crazy child. Grenada, she have sunshine. She have blue sky. She have nutmeg and cinnamon and ginger.
Looking out at the grey July day, then turning to beam down at me, and with an enthusiasm that made me want to taste it.
And she have rum.
Had it been just me, my father and my mother, had Lukey not been lying in his white cot, I might have said,
"Can we go there, Daddy? Can we go live in Grenada, with its blue sky, its cinnamon and rum?"
But somehow I knew, before I knew why, that my mother would not sanction Lukey going there. Dad must have known it too, because sitting on the nursing chair beside Lukey's cot, he said,
"Come here, Coffee Bean."
I was either Coffee Bean or Lenny, never Arlene.
"Yees locks is coming undone. What's your mother doing these days? Not plaiting that boy's hair for sure."
And I stood between my father's legs, my hands on his knobbly knees, as his bony fingers deftly plaited my unruly hair, feeling safe in the pincer grip of his long-limbed presence.
"You know, Lenny girl," he said, "blue sky can get a bit boring day after day, and a man can have too much rum."
"Even a cinnamon?"
"Especially a cinnamon. Those cinnamon would have done well not to have touched it in the first place. But man is weak, Lenny girl. Man is weak."
"But Lukey won't be weak."
His big hands gripping my small shoulders, my father turned me round to face him.
"Lenny, your brother is special, like any child is special, and he'll need to be strong for sure. But that boy won't be no saint, and I hope he won't be no sinner man either."
"He won't be," I said, with all the certainty of the innocent.
"He can't be. Lukey's extra special."
Although my work as a short story writer has been published in anthologies and on websites celebrating literary fiction, Appetites is the first collection of my work to be published, but not the first collection to be written. For I wrote my first batch of stories at the age of 5 or 6. I called it Bunny Tales, although I cannot be certain if the spelling of the tale was the T-A-L-E or the T-A-I-L one. But my distant memory tells me I had an awareness of the punning title, punning finding its way into my cartoon work much later and throughout my life, probably to the irritation of many and the amusement of a few. Punning, one of the great joys of the wonderfully witty, flexible English language. Whether there were 3, 4, or 5 tales of Bunnyland, I do not know. The stories, such as they were, probably only covered 1 or 2 pages each, the large, round, pencil-written letters amounting to only a handful of words on pages cut to landscape proportions. 2 holes were made in the left-hand side of the paper, a narrow piece of ribbon threaded through to bind my first collection together. Was the joy of that very first experience greater back then than the joy I feel now when reaching the end of a new piece of work, I wonder? Perhaps not. Perhaps the creative child I've carried with me through life feels the same as she did then. Storytelling, whether published or not, a pleasure, a necessity, a part of life. The only downside now being the inner critic living alongside my inner child is never satisfied for long. The delight of the night before can become gloom come the reread the next morning, the next month, the next year. The honing, the polishing, the need to make small improvements, takes a lot longer now than it did at 5 or 6. I don't know if my parents treasured their little writer's first short story collection. My own recollection of it remains only in my mind's eye, my long-fingered child's hand threading ribbon through those 2 holes. Over the intervening decades, the furry-tailed, two-dimensional creatures of my first creation probably became habitat for 3-dimensional ones, for mice and woodlice, for beetles and silverfish, those few landscape pages of paper disintegrating to dust. Some 2 decades ago, my mother returned my so-called novels to me, along with a few of those grey classroom books I'd filled with illustrated stories at my not-so-illustrious primary school. More were found in my mother's house 2 years ago, when clearing it before it was sold to continue funding what sadly turned out to be the last year of her life in the care home. But there was no sign of Bunny Tales, so I shall never know if the tale, written in my big round hand, my first effort at storytelling, had an I or an E in it. And speaking of a child's hand, this is a good moment to return to Running Away and my final extract from it. A shorter piece this time, towards the end of the story, though not the story's end. Running Away. I wrote a story on Lukey's back once. I can see my brown finger now moving across the sweaty whiteness of his parchment skin. A scorching summer's day. He was about 7 years old. Our storytelling game had begun 3 years before. Give me your hand, Lukey. No, don't look. You're to feel the letters. O-N-C-E-U-P-O-N. I shaped the words on his palm. Dad had left that march. Were answer. Once upon a time, Lukey cried out. I can do it, can't I, Arlene? My skin can read. Sure you can do it, Lukey. You are the cleverest boy in the universe. I was away at university. A year of retakes, and I'd finally got a place. Though not the place I wanted. Not a place close to home, close to Lukey. It was snowing again. The previous weekend I hadn't managed to get home, and that week hadn't spoken to Lukey for 5 days. He'd been in hospital for 3 of them. His eyes again. How'd it go? It was a Wednesday evening. Mum was out. She had been out a lot lately, he said. I hated to think of him alone in that claustrophobic little flat.
Oh, you know, Lenny, Lukey said.
He'd not called me Lenny for years, our mother insisting on reinstating Arlene soon after Dad left. Same old shit. He sounded cheerful enough in that world-weary way of his, Lukey not having a great deal to smile about. Not one to smile a great deal. I'll be with you Friday, I said. The weather forecast's pretty good.
You're always with me, Lenny girl.
He was barely 14, but his voice had a deep resonance that reminded me of Dad.
Always, he repeated.
He was found spread-eagled in the snow, his eyes, unprotected by the sunglasses Mum insisted he carry with him at all times, gazing up into the crystal-clear blue that had followed the sub-zero temperatures of the previous night, his mouth frozen in a smile. I hope that's of some comfort to you, the doctor who had attended the scene said. It wasn't, but has since become so. Maybe you've gone home, I whispered as I touched Lukey's hand. May I? turning to the doctor. "Of course," the doctor said. "I'll be outside." LOVEYOUALWAYS, my finger wrote on my brother's bloodless palm. Maybe, I thought, somewhere where the sun shines down on everyone. Lukey's skin might read these words, might never forget them. Thanks for listening to this first on the shelf. And I hope you'll join me here next time. Bye till then.